In our series, Debut Discussions, we're asking debut authors to tell us their story. Not only the story in the novel they wrote, but the journey they took to hold that book in their hands. On today's episode, we welcome Sarah Jane Collins. Sarah is a writer, editor, and journalist from Brisbane, Australia, who moved to New York by way of Sydney. Her work appeared in The Age, The Sydney Morning Herald, Mianjin, Overland, and others. She has an MFA in fiction from Columbia University. Her fiction has won the Overland Fair Australia Prize and has been shortlisted for other awards. Although New York is now her home, she misses the beaches of Australia, but not the spiders. I'm like, can we ask about the spiders?
Do we want to ask about the spiders?
Probably not. I don't like creepy, crawly things. Her debut novel, Radiant Heat, is out now. Welcome to Pop Fiction Women, Sarah.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
Well, we are excited to get into Radiant Heat, but before we do, we like to go back in time with our debut authors because most writers begin as readers. So what is the story of young Sarah as a reader?
It's a large amount of books. I come from a family of voracious readers, and I was really very blessed as a kid to have, I lived with my mum and my grandma, and the house that we lived in had this whole upstairs area that was kind of sort of abandoned because it was built by my grandfather in the 1960s. And he had bought it to throw parties. So there was a dance floor and a bar and a fireplace and this like shaggy carpet lounge. But when he passed away, my grandmother was kind of like, well, I don't really want to go up there anymore because that was his space. And so she put all of the books up there, right? So we had like a library in our upstairs full of all of the books that my mom and my aunt and uncle had read growing up, and all of my nan's books and all of my grandfather's books. And so it was probably like 1,000 books up there. And I just would go up there when it wasn't too hot, because when it was hot, it was unbearable being up there. And I would just pick something up from the shelf and read it. And my parents both had a really good philosophy of not hiding stuff from us. Like, we were allowed to read basically anything we wanted to read, with the exception of, I remember, Flowers in the Attic was banned.
That's fair.
But my dad did send me to school with a Patricia Cornwell novel when I was 10, and my teacher was like, do your parents know you're reading that? And I was like, oh, my dad said he thought I would like it. So yeah, I mean, I've been reading since the day I learned how, and my brother, I have such strong memories of walking past his bedroom in the summer holidays, and he's just always lying on his bed with a book reading. I was a little bit more of an outdoors kid than he was, but I still had to try and keep up with him. So there was a lot of competition in the house who's read more books, you know. He definitely won that competition, but it meant that I read a lot as well. So yeah, I mean, but I don't know. I can't.
Yeah.
Sorry, you go.
I was just going to say, but I hope you fully won now that you wrote your own book. That's got to be something to hold over your brother.
That's right.
I like to think that in our 40s, we can move on from these competitions.
So do I, but
very
I have a
well
brother
said.
Too, so yeah. That's good though.
I think he still probably reads more than I do, but I write more than he does, so that's okay.
Okay.
There you go.
Evens out.
You can split the wins. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Exactly.
So clearly an entire environment, not just you and your escape, but just this something that was really fostered by your environment growing up.
That's very much so.
So that makes a little bit more sense, I think, for me. So I'm excited to chat with you today because your path is a little more linear than some of the other authors we chat with, certainly the ones we've actually had on for this debut discussion series. Because you went to school for your MFA in fiction. It makes sense, though, that you saw and knew that this was a thing, to write books, to be an author, you know, to be around that kind of environment. It sounds like legitimized it for you in a certain way. So when did you know you wanted to write a novel? And when did you decide that was serious enough to go to Columbia for that MFA?
Yeah, it's... That's such an interesting question that has so many stages. Because I think I knew from when I was very small that I wanted to write, because that was the thing that I was good at and that I loved to do. But I also was pragmatic as a child, and I didn't feel that writing novels was something that would mean that you could pay your bills. And so I kind of looked around, and I guess I was probably like 8 or so when I made this decision. I remember writing about it in my diary, but I kind of was like, okay, the way to be a writer and make money is to be a newspaper reporter. And so, you know, for people who are younger, that was probably not something that would make any sense to someone today. But in the early 1990s, before the internet wrecked print journalism, that was a really solid career. So I kind of went, you know, novels is my dream, but dreams have to also be tempered by the world and reality. That was the kind of like child I was. And so I went, okay, I want to be a journalist. And I worked towards that for a really long time. And I went to university and in Australia and just did an arts degree with a history major, because I felt like that was the best way to kind of understand society to report on it. And I was very lucky. I got a cadetship straight out of university and went to work for one of the best newspapers in Australia. Had an incredible time working there. And then, you know, that was a time of great change in the industry. And I saw 5 rounds of redundancies, of layoffs at my newspaper. I got offered a job with an internet startup, and I thought, well, you know, that's the future. So I went and took it. And as a lot of internet startups do, it didn't do as well as they had hoped, and we all lost our jobs. and it was at that point then, when I'd already been working for almost 10 years, not quite that long, but for a while, that I actually had some time in my day to think about what I really wanted to write about. And I was sort of like coming up to 30 and had free time. And so I started writing fiction, and I hadn't done that since high school. And it was really liberating to do. And so I wrote a few short stories. I entered some competitions. I had some success with that. And I wrote one day the first chapter of Radiant Heat. It just kind of came to me like, oh, this is a thing I want to do. And I wrote that, and I thought this could be more than just a short story. This feels like something longer, but I don't even know how I would go about that. And so I sort of just went, maybe the thing to do is to study. And at that point I looked around, and I had always wanted to live in New York. It's always been a dream of mine to study at Columbia. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to study, I may as well try and do it in that place and change my life. And so that's what I did. And I wrote the book, pretty much all of the book, whilst I was at Columbia studying. But the whole process from writing that first chapter and the book coming out in January was almost 10 years. So, you know, long time.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. And I did read that you said it was very ironic that you did not pursue writing, being a writer, because it would be you know, like we said, it's not pragmatic, financial stability. And then you're like, and then I chose a career that basically went away.
Basically went away. And, you know, like two of my journalism jobs have ended in the place I worked shutting down. So, you know, it's like. Right.
So.
Well, let me tell you, 2 of my finance jobs ended that way too. So, you know, that's sometimes it's economy. Sometimes it's, you know, just how it happens.
And I feel like it enabled me to take more risks and be less cautious. And that was a real gift. So I mean, I guess that's how universe, I ended up here.
So you had that seed, but then the window of opportunity came, which is, if you don't have the seed, the window can easily pass you by, but you were carrying that thought with you, like, maybe I could do this. And then that window came and you were just gung-ho right through it.
I think as well, for people that work in writing in their day-to-day job, particularly like when I worked for the newspaper, I was filing, you know, 2 to 4 stories a day, and my deadlines were tight, and it had to be perfect. You know, it had to be good, and it had to be accurate, and it had to be interesting. And that takes a lot of your creative energy, and you don't really have a lot left at the end of the day. And so it was only really when I had the opportunity to slow down and step back from that daily cycle of cultivating sources, finding stories, producing stories, that I was able to then go, well, what stories do I really want to tell? And that was really the opening, you know?
Yeah. So you wrote this during your MFA program. Why, and you might as well take the time now to give us maybe the elevator pitch for Radiant Heat.
Okay, so Radiant Heat, it is set in the aftermath of a really big catastrophic bushfire, a wildfire, and it uses the tropes of a thriller to interrogate issues of violence against women and the kind of the threat of living in Australian rural and regional areas, not just from the bush, but also from the people around you. And that's not a very good elevator pitch, but I feel like I'm not good at elevator pitches.
They are an art to themselves, right? It's like querying like blurbs. But no, that was excellent anyway. But I do agree, it's a separate skill. And you've touched on so many things that I want to talk about when we dive into this. The novel follows Allison King, who has, right at the opening, just survived this fire, but she's, as we learned, she's still in danger. And this intense scene of her surviving that wildfire in the bathtub is so visceral. And also throughout the novel, so are its callbacks. Like when she's describing even more of what it felt like and what the experience was when she's talking to the detective and she's with Sal. She can't kind of stop pressing on the bruise that is her survival. And it brings up kind of discordant emotions like anger. She's angry, but she's glad she's alive, but she's confused as to how it all happened, why her, and what happened outside. And she says at one point, dying was easy. And then she had to live and have to deal with this. Tell us about the origin of the inciting incident that doesn't just start the story, but it really is part of her character.
When I first started working on this, was only about, I think, 3 years after the largest, most seriously devastating bushfire in Australian history up to that moment in time, which was the Black Saturday fires in Victoria in 2009, February 6th, I think they were. And I lived in Melbourne at the time. I worked for the newspaper, The Age, in Melbourne. And the fires were just outside of Melbourne, so they were close. And that fire killed 173 people. It devastated the landscape in a way that we had never seen before. It forced so many changes in fire management and how we talk about bushfires in Australia. And it was the subject of a long and very detailed Royal Commission, which is like an Australian Senate inquiry, like the, you know, like the Congress has those big Senate, it's kind of like that, but a little bit different. Anyway, it was the subject of one of those. And it really left a huge impression on me as somebody that had lived in the region and had kind of that day, just, it was a surreal day because it was so, the atmosphere in Melbourne was so weird and hot and oppressed. But then the next day, when we started learning the extent of what had happened with the fire, it was just this whole other layer of, oh my God. And, you know, I knew people that knew people who had lost someone. And one of my colleagues from a different newspaper wrote an incredible account of his survival that stays with me to this day. And I then, in the next year after the fires, spent the time, my job was covering state politics. And as the junior reporter in the office, I was always sent out to cover the premier, so like the governor, when he was out in the regions announcing whatever he was announcing. And he was, that year, he spent a lot of time announcing reconstruction projects. So I was going to morning teas and afternoon teas and meeting people that had survived these fires, and they were telling me their stories. And it was just a lot. It was a lot to take in, and it was a lot to think about. And I guess I just never, that never left me.
Yeah.
And I was really curious to kind of think about the question of, this is one thing that happens in these people's lives. It's a huge thing, and it might define a large chunk of their life, but they had a life before and they have to have a life afterwards. And what does that look like and how does that work? And that's sort of one of the things that I wanted to tackle in this book.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and it's clear your journalism background is sort of all over this novel. I mean, as you're saying, your time at the newspaper really informed it as you're talking about the bushfires. But also, you know, I read an article in which you also talked about how, you know, the coverage and then of the court systems, elements of criminal law, that all of those things that you were exposed to as a journalist really shaped this story. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So obviously the fire is the thing that, right, that starts it off. But that thing I was just talking about, that people have the life before and the life after, is what is then for me the propelling sort of motion of the story. And that, I guess, the issues that I wanted to grapple with were the other thing that I saw a lot of in my job as a journalist that really stayed with me and shocked me, was the awful treatment of women in Australian society. And I'm not going to say it's just Australian society. I would say probably you would find it everywhere.
Yes.
But the place that I was Australia. So that's my area of knowing. Just the things we hear about domestic violence and violence against women and sexual violence, they're the tip of a huge iceberg. And I guess I wanted to kind of grapple with some of the elements of that and some of these ideas around what does PTSD look like and what's survivor's guilt and how do they live, how do they make a life when they're trying to run away from a life they used to have. Mm-hmm. And these all sound like very abstract concepts, but I guess I'm trying to be abstract because I don't want to spoil the book too much.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's good. Yeah.
But basically, you know, Alison, she finds a dead woman in her driveway after she manages to survive the fire. And that woman, she's never met her before, but she's coming to Alison and Alison doesn't know why. And then she's kind of compelled by her own, I guess, grief and survivor's guilt to figure out who this woman was and what she's doing there. And it turns out that they have a very dark connection.
Yes. But that is the mystery, Simone, the mystery that propels the story. And that's what I was turning every page to find out, the connection between the two of them and how, even when you have an idea, how it will play out. So did you know when you started that you wanted to write literary crime fiction? Was this,
I mean, as I said, I took a Patricia Cornwell with me to school when I was 10.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I love a crime fiction and I love literary fiction and I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. Tana French is one of my favorite writers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for people that don't know him, Peter Temple, he's South African, but he lived and mostly worked in Australia. His work is beautiful and amazing and great. So, I mean, and he was a real influence to me. I think that the thing that I love about the idea of literary crime fiction is we get so much crime fiction that's about just plot. Like it's about, you know, what's the mystery? How do we solve it? It's not concerned with what happens to the people that are part of the story. Mm. It's just concerned with the dead body and the person that created the dead body and not really anything else in between. Yeah. And I think we see in the stuff that I've seen, I'm thinking now about like things like Mayor of Easttown, Sharp Objects, on television, that are like these nuanced portrayals of not just the crime, but the people that are impacted by the crime. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's way more interesting than just here's a dead body. I mean, not to diss Agatha Christie because I obviously love her.
Yeah.
But you know, for me, the mystery itself is not what drives me. It's what the mystery means to the people that are living through it. And so that's why I feel like this book is a little bit, maybe it's not going to be what some people expect it to be, because it does give you plot elements that you think you're not going to get until later, earlier. And it does do that on purpose. I don't want people to spend the whole book going, oh, what's the connection between them? I want them to go, oh, this connection is here, but what does that connection mean for them?
Yes.
You know? Because that's where I'm interested.
Yeah. By the way, I'd add to that list too, Britt Marling's Murder at the End of the World. That was another one that, deep character stuff. And because you give Alison is playing detective and we already know so much about her and why she's pursuing Simone, with her own kind of baggage, her own trauma that she's carrying, you know, so much more depth and texture to that story. I love it.
I am Patty Callahan Henry.
I am Mary Kay Andrews.
I'm Kristen Harbell.
And I'm Christy Whitson Harvey.
Friends in Fiction is led by four longtime friends, the four of us, with more than 75 published books between us.
Through in-depth conversations and interviews, we discuss the books we've written, the books we're reading, and the art of storytelling.
We're here with endless stories to support indie bookstores, authors, librarians, and readers just like you.
We are always seeking innovative ways to introduce dynamic voices and trends in publishing.
On this channel, you will find hundreds of episodes with some of your favorite authors, including the four of us with our new releases, as we reveal the stories behind the stories, offer writing tips, and talk about the creation of novels, memoirs, and nonfiction titles.
So, if you love books and you're curious about the writing world, you are in the right place.
You can listen to Friends and Fiction on any major streaming platform.
Thank you.
You know, and then the knock on literary fiction is nothing happens. So you, this is good. Yeah. This combo of blending these two, I think, is a nice, perfect balance.
Yeah. Right. A friend of mine, actually, he posted an Instagram story this morning about how the reason he likes literary fiction is because that's where you find the empathy. Like, that's where you learn to empathize with other people. And I think, I mean, for me, empathy is it's the number one reason why I write. That's the thing that I care most about, is trying to open up people's minds to different perspectives. And that's always been my driver. Like, even as a little kid, that was like, I would have a fight with my mother, and then I would write her this like long-winded note about all of my feelings and like throw it over the wall so that she would get it in the other room. You know, like, cause I was just like, this is how I do it. This is how I express what I'm trying to convey to you, and how I feel I can do that most clearly. So that's a thing.
Yeah. And you expressed it when you were talking about why you wrote this, right? Like, thinking about the fire, the accounts that left an impression on you, and just thinking about what it means to have a life before and then to have a life after, kind of in a traumatic incident. You're thinking about it. And so, of course, that's what you want to develop in the story. It makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. My dad called it feminist noir. And I was like, oh, yeah, I like it. I love it. Yeah.
So you work on this during your MFA program. And, you know, we always love to ask our debut authors about getting your agent, which is, for anyone aspiring to be an author, is a very daunting process. So,
right. Did you go through the query trenches, or were you able to connect at your MFA program, or you weren't for enough long? Tell us about that.
It's kind of a bit of all of it. So I finished the MFA, and then I finished a version of the book that I felt was queryable, which, you know, getting there is also a hard thing to do, because you're always trying to fix it and make it like a little bit better. And eventually you just have to go, I can't fix this anymore by myself. I need someone else to help me. And that's the point at which I think people should start querying, because then hopefully you find someone that sees what you see and can collaborate with you to make it even better. And so when I hit that point, which was in probably, I want to say like late 2018, I started sending out queries to agents, people that I thought were suitable. I had a couple of, well, I'm not quite sure that this is for me, but, you know, don't give ups, and a lot of no thank you and a lot of nothing. And actually a really good friend of mine from the program and I were kind of going through the process at the same time, and we were sending each other like the tallies of the rejections that we were getting, and it was just like, oh God. And then at the same time, I had a friend from the program who was just becoming an agent, and we were at a party, and I mentioned my book to her as a friend, just like, you know, I'm just chatting as a friend. And she said, oh, you know, if you want to, you can send it to me and I can maybe suggest some people that you could query or whatever, like, I'll see how I can help. And so I sent it to her, and then a week later, I was at Columbia does this thing, an agent's mixer, where they invite students who have finished the program and agents to come together and chat about books and see if you can find a match. And I was at that and I ran into one of my professors and he was like, how's this going? And I said, oh, you know, I've sent out like 100 queries and nothing's really worked out and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, oh, I'll have a think about it and I'll email you. I said, okay. And 2 days later, he emailed me and a bunch of agents and was like, she's going to send her manuscript to you. And I was like, oh, I guess I'm doing that now. And one of them just happened to be at the same agency as my friend. And so then I messaged my friend and said, listen, I have to send my manuscript to this person at your agency because my professor had said I was going to, so I'm not going to not do that. She was like, damn it, because I want it. So I have two. She said, and I know that agent is going to want it too. And she did. And so they signed me together. They brought me in together and I work with them both, but predominantly I work with my friend, my agent, Mina Hamedi, who is wonderful. It was just one of those things where it's like, you know, I did the stuff where I sent all the emails and then I also did the Columbia thing. And I, you know, so it was
and
a lot of different
thing. Yeah.
And the friend thing. Yeah.
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 Exactly. You got to work all of the angles.
Amen.
Yes. That's right.
Wow. But I feel like I ended up with exactly the right person and the right people, the right team. It was meant to be.
We love that. So then you sign with them. Do you do anything editorial or is it ready to go? You do. Okay, more. And then you're at a submission and what's that like?
Right. So really the predominant development work with the manuscript once you've finished your draft and found someone who wants to represent it is with that agent. So that we did a bunch of rounds of edits and that kind of ended up coinciding with COVID. So everything kind of slowed down a lot and there was a lot of waiting. There's a lot of waiting in publishing. And so there was a lot of like, you know, get a round of edits back, read them, make my changes, send that back, wait until we finally got to a point in, late 2021 where they were like, we're happy with it. We're going to send it out, but we're not going to send it out yet. Because it's the end of the year, and it's better to wait until until the start of the year. So then we ended up sending it out in March of 2022, and I was really lucky because that process can take forever.
Oh boy, yes.
Like it can take months and months. So it can take a year. It can take a long time. And in fact, I know someone who put their book out to query at the same time as I put this out to query and theirs is still on query. And it's not that it's not going to end up someday finding a home. It's just hasn't found one yet.
Exactly.
But we had interest within a couple of weeks and then you talk to people and you pick who you like and you go from there. It was kind of nuts because I thought, oh God, I prepared myself for months and months of, you know, tenderhooks, but not to be, thank goodness.
Well, it seems like the getting your agent and the submission process was meant to be, though. I just heard you say if you believe in that stuff, which we do believe in, which is my lead in to the question we ask all our authors, which is what's your sign and do you relate to it? Because we are astrology fans over here.
Yes.
Well, I think I need to ask, first of all, what you think my sign is. If you're astrology nuts and you've just listened to me talk about things that matter
to
me.
We like to take guesses. We like to take guesses.
We do, but I will say that the beginning I was definitely thinking, but I don't know if it's a sun and moon clash. So I can't say, other than I guess I could just, so many things made me think of Kate, which could also be the second born thing. So there's like a couple things, but I would go with Leo if there was anything.
That's what I was going to say, Leo or a fixed sign. But she's saying you remind you that we're simpatico here.
So much.
So you're not wrong, but you're also not correct.
That's my favorite thing to be, by the way. Tell me.
Leo is my rising sign.
Okay.
Makes total sense.
I am a Cancer.
Okay.
My moon is Scorpio. So.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah. And that's fixed, by the way. That's a fixed sign. Fixed in nature. Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She knows. Yes. She's yes, I know.
I have a lot of water in my chart and a lot of air and fire. I have no earth at all, I don't think.
Interesting. So
I love it.
It's an interesting chart. My parents are... My whole immediate family is water signs. My brother is also a Cancer. My mom is a Scorpio. And my dad is a Pisces.
Gosh. My family is split half water, half fire. My family of origin. But then my family, my kids are all water, all Pisces. Pisces, Pisces, Pisces everywhere. As far as the eye can see.
I love a Pisces.
Yeah. Water. That makes sense, by the way.
It's birthday season for you now, then.
Oh, thankfully it just passed. Whew.
For her kids, it is. She just got through those.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
but we guess Leo, so but you that's care. Your rising. So that's right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Like every person, I feel like around my age, I'm interested in the astrology stuff. I don't know. Like I feel like it's the one thing where you get to have a little bit of fun with it, but also there's something kind of grounding about it, which is nice that I don't find in other spiritualities as much.
I agree.
Because you kind of you look up in the sky and there is the sun and the moon and the stars. They're all there.
You know? Yeah, and they
were there
away.
When you were born that's in right. a certain yeah. place,
and,
right?
Yes. So, and as a water baby, you know, I really the tides are very important to me.
So. Yeah,
the full Every the moon, time someone, the full moon.
Yeah, yeah, I'm like, you don't believe in astrology, but do you know that the moon affects the tides? Like these things are, you know, like
these are real things.
You can't just wholesale be like, there's nothing behind it. So.
I just feel like I can definitely, I can't take that seriously from anyone that is like, but by the way, you know, this religious thing, you know?
Right. It's like, this happen. Yeah. And then like right away they were like, but I believe in ghosts. And I'm like, what? I mean, you can't poop. You can be like, that's yours, this is mine. But you can't be like, that's ridiculous. Right. But I believe in ghosts. Totally. Like, okay. All right. Well,
I was I was raised Catholic originally, and so like I have a grounding in religion and the church and in the Bible, and I kind of grew up thinking these are just allegories, they're just stories.
Yes.
But there are plenty of people that believe in that, and that's fine, you know, believe in that. But I kind of feel like sometimes I meet a person, I'm like, you are just so an Aries. Like, that's what you are.
There's no denying.
When it fits, you're like, pretend I didn't just say it was Aries. Let me just describe exactly the characteristics. Yeah. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's me. I'm like, okay, then forget that I gave you the sign because I just pegged you to 100%.
Right.
It's like my best friend here in the States, she's a double Aquarius with a Leo rising. She's like, I don't believe in astrology. It's nonsense. Like, it's just crazy. But then she's like, have you read this latest conspiracy theory on? I'm just like, oh my God.
Yeah. You're like, oh, that's your nonsense. This is my nonsense. Let's coexist with all of our nonsense. Yeah.
That's
I went through a period. Yeah. Sorry. I went through a period of sending her astrology memes of Aquarius stuff. And she was like, I don't like this.
Because it's true.
Exactly.
Because you know it rings true. You can it resonates with you. I love it. Yeah. I love it. Well, we love an author that comes on with their big three because it doesn't happen all that much and it's such a
kindred
delight
spirit.
For us. Exactly. I also love that the rising sign, the way you present, was very clear to us.
That's right.
I did an astrology tattoo session a few years ago. And so the artist, they read your chart with you and you go through a whole like session about all your placements and then you pick a custom tattoo and then you get the tattoo. And I had been looking at all the different elements before my session and I was like, oh, this little Leo lion is so cute. Like, I love it so much, but I'm not a Leo, I'm a Cancer. Like, I can't get the lion. Mm-hmm. And then we went through my chart and they were like, no, you could totally get the Leo because the way that you present, and then I was like, okay, great, let's do it.
Yeah.
So you have a Leo tattoo?
Well, I have it. It's all three. I don't know if I can.
That's so cool.
Oh my God, I love it. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Super on cool.
If people are interested.
Yeah. Yes. Very no. cool.
Amazing.
Oh my gosh. Wow. You really brought it today. Thank yeah. you.
Yes.
No worries. Yeah. So we want to end this conversation with what you're loving right now. We've already touched on some TV shows. I mean, you really did A++ on this things conversation like. Being, yeah, totally in line with everything we do here at Pop Fiction Women. So what are you loving right now?
Oh, that's such a hard one.
It is.
You know, the most recent thing that I love that I rave to everyone about and I can't be more of an ambassador for is the Australian limited series Deadlock, which is on Amazon Prime. And it's Loch like Loch Ness Monster. So like means lake, but it's basically a kind of a comedy, but also very well executed crime mystery series. If you aren't Australian, you might want to have subtitles on. Because
I always really do leans, anyway. Yes,
it,
but yes.
It really leans into the Ocker end yeah. of the Australian accent mm-hmm. at some points. And there's a lot of hilarious slang in there that you would probably need to pause to understand. But it's wonderful. It's basically about men start dying in a small town in Tasmania, and the detectives that are in charge of investigating it are women. There's a lot of like satire in there, but there's also possibly the most perfect skewering of ally men that aren't really allies mm-hmm. as well.
Mm. Yeah.
It's just it's wonderful.
Allyship. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really wonderful and so funny and so brilliant. And the suspense, they nail the suspense as well. So that is something I loved and highly recommend. And okay. I just recently finally saw Past Lives, which is...
Oh, we just yep. covered that. Yeah.
Amazing.
So good.
I did. Yeah. I saw that you guys had just covered
oh,
it.
But, yeah. I'm yeah. obsessed. So good.
I haven't stopped thinking about it. And mm-hmm. It's just for somebody who has moved to another country without as much of a culture shock, but still... There is a bit of a culture shock there.
Yeah,
It really resonated for me on a lot of levels, and it's just so beautifully done. And yeah, then, really what else? What else? The other movie I saw recently that I couldn't stop thinking about is Poor Things, which is
it's been on my list.
I know I haven't seen it yet, but I want to.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, you're pushing us over the edge.
Yeah,
yeah. I really loved it. I think it is polarizing. I went online and read some reviews afterwards. I never read reviews beforehand. Yeah, they either loved it or they hated it. Loved it.
That's okay. We like that.
Yeah.
We don't want to be you don't want to be neutral.
No.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, those are some great suggestions.
Yeah.
I was gonna say I feel like I should recommend a book as well, but I read so many that they're all just kind of coalescing in my mind.
Story of my life.
Literally the story of our lives.
Yeah. Like, so don't worry. Yeah. We got plenty of those.
Yeah.
Exactly. But this was so
shoot us a DM
great.
If you think of something we can add into the show notes at the end.
But, well, I mean, I did earlier recommend Peter Temple, and I would say
that's
as
right.
much as I mm-hmm. try very much to recommend female authors first, if you are a person that enjoys literary crime fiction and likes an Australian setting, his novels are fantastic. And there's also a TV series. I don't know if it's available in the States, but it's got Guy Pearce plays the lead in it. And it's like, it's really good.
Okay. Yeah. Have you right. read Flowers in the Attic since you're not allowed to?
I've never read it.
Oh my God.
Wow. Okay.
I was a good kid and I was like, okay, we're not allowed to read this. So I didn't read it. And then I got older and I was just like, well, do I really want to read this?
Do you know, I recently reread it. It
really?
Is, but I already had the experience of reading it too young and all, so I don't know, but it really still landed for me. I was like, wow, this
yeah,
I
mean, okay.
It's, yeah.
I haven't read it since I was a kid.
It's strong.
So.
It's a strong read.
I did, I mean, whilst I was reading Patricia Cornwell, I was also collecting Trixie Belden. Have you guys ever heard of Trixie Belden?
Yeah, yes, yes.
Which is like the other end of the spectrum.
Yes,
it's like very,
I was going to say.
Like very young kid solving crime.
Yes,
it's so
exactly.
fun and delightful. And I loved mm-hmm. it so much. And my dad and I, we used to have this thing where we would, every place we went, we'd go on summer holidays to beach towns and there would always be a secondhand bookshop. And we would go to the secondhand bookshop and look for any of the Trixie Beldens that we didn't have already.
Right.
That was like, I ended up having a shelf with like 45 Trixie Belden books.
That's
great.
Fun.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Fun. That's a fun one if you have like... Yeah. girls that love mysteries. I recommend them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow.
Well, Radiant Heat is out now. Thank you so much for joining us. This was such a wonderful conversation. And
thank you for having me.
And it was a fantastic read. So
yes. And enjoy.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. Your debut-ness. Yes. Embrace it.
You're a little bit out. Has it sunk in? Do you feel like...
It feels, you know, this is not a great way to describe it, but all of my other author friends that I've talked to about it have been like, I understand that. It sort of feels a little bit like I imagine it might feel to have, and obviously I'm not equating the two at all, but how it might feel to have postnatal depression. You know, like you've speak with you and you've like shepherded it into the world and then there it is. And maybe like, it's not... Like, you know, you read the Goodreads reviews that aren't as glowing as you would like them to be. And you're like, people don't understand it the way I understand it. So you have like that element of, but at the same time, it's like, this is a thing I thought I would never do because I was going to be pragmatic. And, you know, the 5-year-old me would be like, what? You live in New York and you wrote a book? That's amazing. Like,
so I have to live in, you're living the dream. Yeah, it is hard. Yeah.
Have to remind myself of that and, you know, and just kind of like enjoy the good, like this conversation, which is great, you know.
Thank you.
And thank you.
And I am going to go pick my daughter up from school and then leave you a 5-star review. So don't you worry.
Yes. I have to go pick my son up now too. Yeah. So look at that. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye.